On today's roundtable, more about military views on Iraq and a probable troop surge there. We'll also take a closer look at the death toll in Iraq. Joining us from King of Prussia, Pennsylvania, is Renee Amore, president of the Amore Group, communications and healthcare consulting firm. Also with us, E.R. Shipp, the Lawrence Stetson Distinguished Professor in Journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. And Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle, sits in Nashville. Welcome to each of you, and I know that you've just listened to our conversation about how troops divide on the Iraq war. Later today, the president is expected to announce he'll increase troops in Iraq by 20,000. He's also expected to announce increased economic aid to the country in exchange for Iraq's curbing sectarian violence. Jeff, let me start with you. We heard two different men, one who served in Iraq, one who's currently serving in the military, two different views on the war from within the military. Do we know enough about what people in the military actually want at this point in time?
No, I don't think we do. And I've had plenty of conversations with people who have been deployed and spent time in Iraq, as I'm sure many of us have. When you talk about having family gatherings for Christmas, and depending on the closeness that you have in your family, people will share things and they'll say very frankly, well, this is something I couldn't, you know, I wouldn't say out in public, or I wouldn't say, I can't say it because I'm in the military, but, you know, this is really messed up here and this is what it's really like over there. So I think being able to hear it in a public forum is really a fascinating thing. And to note the differences in the dissent, a soldier's job is indeed to fight. But at some point, especially after an extended period of death and destruction and witnessing that, I think you start to think less like a soldier and more like a free thinking human being. And that's way beyond the kind of pumped up, locked and loaded kind of mentality that some people in the military have. It's what I call the video game mentality. And we get all of these really cool weapons and the cameras on the bombs and the night vision goggles and the smart bombs and the like, and you want to use them at some point. I was in a bus station the other day and saw some soldiers being deployed, and there were four of them lined up against the wall. All of them were maybe 19 years old, four skinny little kids in uniforms. One was playing games on a laptop, one was watching a video on an iPod, and two were playing PlayStations. And that picture really got me, because aside from the camouflage, these were the same kids I just saw in the campus cafeteria doing the same things. But only a few days, they'll be killing people or dying for a cause that most of America doesn't want to be involved in. So I think that eventually many of those kids come of age. Some will become hardened killers and some will become free thinkers. And I think we have to make room for the notion that people do exist on both sides of that mentality.
Renee, what about this surge? We're going to find out more shortly about what the president is recommending. But at this point, is a troop surge a good idea?
I think we're at a point right now, something that Tony Snow happened to say yesterday, that it's a decisive point with the war in Iraq. And the question is not, you know, so much will we win because we have to, but how will we win? And I think that it's important, too, as far as regarding the troop escalation that President Bush is expected to recommend. I support that, and I think in his speech tonight we'll hear more about it and how they're going to really formulate a plan, have a strategic plan, which is important. But I'm not opposed to a short-term escalation of troops, because I think that is very important. But more important than any one tactic, however, is formulating a larger overall strategy and vision for Iraq, because it's real important to do that and have some type of time frame to bring these troops home.
You know, ER Sergeant Neil Saunders, who we heard first, is very much in support of staying the course, in support of a troop surge. At this point, though, there is so much sectarian violence, and we're going to talk about that in a second. So many Iraqis being killed by other Iraqis, not just U.S. troops being killed by Iraqis. Is 20,000, 30,000 troops going to stem that flow of blood?
No. On the American side, it will increase the flow of blood, because we're going to be putting troops in places they should not be. The fight, I believe, yesterday was on rooftops, and American and Iraqi soldiers, about 1,000 total, were running from rooftops to shoot at the insurgents from a building they couldn't figure out Anyway, that's what we're talking about, sending 20 or 30,000 more troops to. And think about this. If there is an additional 20,000, and that's the math needs to be done here, because it looks like we're still going to be recycling some of the troops who've already been there and rescinding agreements on people who thought they were retiring. All of that seems to be part of this 20,000 formula. So it's not necessarily 20,000 fresh people. But anyway, with that, the number of troops on the ground in American uniforms would still be about 140,000, 150,000 max, when various professionals are saying that to really deal with the insurgency in Baghdad, you need 400,000 to 500,000 troops. So this is, as Jeff was using, I like that term, this feels like President Bush, the one who got out of going to Vietnam, doing video game mentality action right here.
I'm going to transfer to move ahead, and Jeff, you can jump in on this,
okay,
on what responsibility we have to Iraqi civilians. Although there have been tragic deaths and maimings of U.S. troops, 3,000 plus deaths so far for the entire conflict for U.S. troops, the Iraqi Health Ministry released statistics on a spike in the violent death of Iraqi civilian and police deaths in 2006. In the first 6 months of last year, 5,600 people were killed, and that number tripled in the latter half of 2006, bringing the total number to 22,950. Now, the gathering of this information is complex, and it may be actually higher than that number, but you're talking about 23,000 Iraqis dead. Do we have any responsibility to think not only about winning this war, but about how we deal with keeping people safe who are in Iraq?
I think we definitely have a responsibility for that. We not only have a responsibility to win a war, but to preserve life, and especially when we go into another region of the world under the auspices of spreading freedom. Now, it used to be that the choice was freedom or death, not that the choice of freedom was death. And I think that that's one of the problems here. And kind of piggybacking on a good point that Renee made was the focus of the troops themselves. What is the focus of the deployment? And I'm sure we'll find out at least some minor details later on tonight. But when you talk about sending more troops, it's not that sending more troops is bad. It's sending focused troops, not just troops that are going to go over there and contribute to this 17 to 23 to 28,000 people that may have been killed in addition to the U.S. troops, but to focus them on securing the country, specialized troops that can provide training for Iraqi security so that this can be shortened, and even utilize the troops that are there to do the same thing. I think the American public sees all of this blood and destruction and can't figure out exactly what we're going to do with the people that we're going to send over there, other than to possibly put them into a death trap that spreads death on all sides. The various ministries over there are in disagreement on the actual number of Iraqi citizens. The Interior Ministry says one thing, the Ministry of Health another, the UN says another thing, and it's indicative of the situation in Iraq in general. No one's on the same page yet.
I want to go ahead and reintroduce everybody. If you're just tuning in, this is NPR's News and Notes, and we've just been listening to Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle. We've also got E.R. Shipp of Hofstra University School of Communication and Renee Moore, president of the Amor Group. I'm Farai Chidea. And Renee, I'm going to go to you next. At some point, what is the task of the United States in Iraq? When we talk about winning a war, which has devolved into infighting within different groups, religious and ethnic, Shia and Sunni, what does it mean to win?
I think what really needs to happen, and I have to go back to what Jeff was saying also, you know, about people being on the same page. One, we all need to be on the same page. I think the U.S. military and Iraqi army view these high deaths of civilians and casualties as, you know, a serious issue, and they're going to take it as priority. But I also feel that we have to deal with helping to restore the peace and building some stability. And to me, that means really educating the people. But also, we have to educate our troops also. And I think that's a serious issue that has been missing, that the education, the communication, just what the real task is, how we're going to go about it, where we are, where we want to go, and how we're going to get there is the bottom line.
Why has it taken 4 years to get there, to raise that question? That's part of what President Bush is going to be talking about in his address. We're told he's going to ask for a surge in troops, but we're also told he wants to ask for perhaps as much as $1 billion, that's with a B, dollars for job creation and all of that kind of stuff. Well, why are we doing it now as opposed to before? Maybe this insurgency would not have happened if there had indeed been a strategy and a vision and a real mission. We're still talking about sending young people, for the most part young, into an environment where they're just there to be cannon fodder. If they're lucky, they come home among the wounded who go to Walter Reed or their Texas hospital or whatever. But what are we talking about here? Why now is strategy and vision and mission important when it wasn't before?
I think, unfortunately, it should have happened. It didn't happen, and now we have to make it happen. We have to hear what the president says tonight, and I think Congress has to be real clear and make sure that the U.S. articulates a clear vision from top down. That means from the president on down, but also the Congress. I think there's been mixed communication about people saying the president lied or no, you lied, and I'm with it, I'm for it, and it got very political. Instead of dealing with human lives, it got real political, and it got involved in the election. And I think now since the election's over, we're at a point that we really need to look at that clear vision. And
we've had a few elections since this war started.
Well,
we never asked the question, what does a soldier do? A soldier is involved in combat, not necessarily is a security specialist. We need to send people who are security specialists there to train their military and security forces on how to keep the peace, as opposed to just teaching people how to fight, because they're going to turn.
You mean
us.
Cops? We need cops.
Well, that's
what I said earlier as far as us dealing with having to restore the peace and building the stability. But again, it's sending people that know how to do it and to train other people to pass that on. Right.
We're going to have to move along. We've got one more topic to get to. Still dealing with politics, but on the domestic front. Now, there's been a lot of talk about the income gap between rich and poor, social mobility. There are a lot of terms that apply to it. But the Democrats said, okay, we're going to close the widening gap between rich and poor. According to the U.S. Census Bureau, however, there is no significant change in income inequality. That doesn't mean that there's not income inequality. It just means that it hasn't really grown very much between 2001 and 2005. That data was released by the Joint Economic Committee. And it comes at a time when the House Financial Services Chairman, Barney Frank, is pushing for the government to reduce inequality through raised wages. The Democrats, of course, pushing for an increased minimum wage. Renee, what do you make about these new numbers?
I'm real clear. I feel that the Democrats rushed to judgment on this one, and they, you know, had a rallying cry, you know, rang hollow, that it wasn't where they said it was be. The fact is the gap between rich and poor has remained fairly consistent. Not to say we shouldn't address the gap, because it's important, but that also doesn't mean we need a new round of programs that eat up tax dollars and, you know, a new round of taxes on businesses. I am a small business owner. It does hit you when you're raising the minimum wage, you know, those type of things, the benefits issues. But, you know, again, we need to look at it and, you know, have a new round of programs.
ER?
I have been a small business owner, too. And I understand that it is very difficult to separate your personal needs as a business owner from what you think is morally right. I think what's morally right is to raise minimum wage. So that as a given, I want to say that just because these statistics seem to be stagnant does not mean that there's not a huge population of people in our country who cannot live on the money that they're being offered. And there's so many people who have given up on looking for jobs, and they're not even counted anymore. So if the numbers seem stagnant, it may be that so many people have dropped out of the pool.
Jeff?
Yes, I too. I complete the triumvirate of small business owners here on the panel, and say from that perspective that it is tough to deal with both the minimum wage, and knowing that, having been in the position where I was making that, I wanted it to be more. You have to balance that out. But I also say that I personally don't think 4 years of measurement is a good indicator of whether the gap is growing significantly or not. I think we need to look over 10 or more years to see if this current generation of people who are now in the workforce are significant and making progress in the workforce are significantly better off than some of the people 10 years before. I think generationally you can tell if that gap is growing better than you can over a period of 4 years.
All right, we're going to leave it there. We've been talking to Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle at Spotland Productions in Nashville. Also, E.R. Shipp, the Lawrence Stetson Distinguished Professor in Journalism at Hofstra University School of Communication. Why y'all got these long titles? It's killing me.
Hey, because it eats up your minutes.
Yeah, I guess so.
For the round table. What can we say?
I know. And also, Renee Amore, president of the Amore Group, a communications and healthcare consulting firm. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And as always, if you'd like to comment on any of the topics you've heard on our roundtable, you can call us at 202-408-3330. That's 202-408-3330. Or you can send an email. Just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. And please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name.
Screams of not feeling wanted, of not being good enough, it almost seems haunted. All her pain soon will be known when she leaves her mom and dad a message after the tone. It says,
you wanna love me, then find somebody else.